Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at Canada.ca.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere des Prairies Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
This is Dragonroot Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragonroot Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragonroot understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
You're a silent forest, you're a wild flower. You've been moving backwards into the wildfire. But you're a sharpened arrow, spearing hearts, stone cold, and you're a red winged blackbird, perched up on the the darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar. But you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window. Child dying, and your heart is coming alive.
You're a full moon rise.
Right, we've got a great interview episode ready for you today. We had the chance to speak with Tori from Medical Her Story. Medical Her Story is a web-based platform for women and femme-identified folks to share their experiences and challenges in regards to healthcare, medicine, and wellness. A little later on in the show, we have a report on chronic pain. But first up is Tori from the amazing project, Medical Her Story. First, for our listeners who aren't familiar with you and the project, can you introduce yourself and tell us about how Medical Her Story came to be?
Of course. So hi, everyone. My name is Tori. I'm the founder of Medical Her Story. We're an award-winning international nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness on gender health equity through storytelling and undoing stigma. So the project was born out of my own lived experience of dealing with chronic yeast infections and sort of navigating these two really challenging barriers. One was like this lack of medical care or compassion that my ailments were receiving, just because I wasn't being taken seriously, but rather treated as being overly emotional and just making a big deal out of nothing, which I promise you I wasn't. The other one was just this silence that I was living in. We're sort of told from a young age that discussing our bodies, especially our genitals, is very inappropriate, very unladylike, and that these are the discourses that just prevented me from feeling comfortable sharing what I was going through with others. So obviously a lot has changed in those years, as this has become something I talk about quite frequently. And I think what happened is that sometimes silence can just become deafening. I got so fed up with all these invasive exams, lost test kits, unsafe referrals, and just so much pain that I had to say something. So funnily enough, I published a story in the McGill Daily, and it made the front page. It garnered attention from other people starting to share their experiences of medical mistreatment they'd been through, other undiagnosed distress they'd been going through, and just general shame around their bodies. So at the time, I knew that there really wasn't a space to be gathering all these stories, and I really wanted there to be, which is why I created Medical Her Story. And now we publish other women and femmes firsthand experiences with health and medicine. We hold educational events, workshops, and we go on some podcasts like this one.
Cool. So you mentioned that the project highlights that medicine is not a domain untouched by larger structures like sexism, racism, classism, ableism. Can you elaborate a bit on what that means for this project?
Yes. So I think a lot of people love to believe that medicine is sort of purely objective, factual, and scientific. But if you're in any way marginalized and have ever found yourself in a situation where you're a patient, then you probably know all too well that medical encounters aren't just influenced by these larger inequalities, but that within like clinical spaces, when you're alone with a doctor, these inequalities can actually become even more concentrated on individual bodies. Mm-hmm. And this can result in a whole range of consequences from having a lack of access, lost hope, or even lost lives. Because if you're, let's say, low income, racialized, disabled, or femme presenting, you're going to face a medical system that not only has this interpersonal and implicit bias coming from medical personnel, but institutional barriers and systems of oppression that are actually embedded within the care you're getting. So while at Medical Her Story, we do focus more on gender health inequity, we have to acknowledge that all forms of oppression are really intertwined and intersecting, and you can't really even understand or begin to address one if you don't acknowledge all of them.
You mentioned barriers. What are these barriers that women and femmes face in the medical setting?
Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to have different experiences, but we do know some things from research. We know that many conditions that affect people with vaginas are under research, they're underfunded, and they're underserved. We know that although women are twice as likely to suffer from chronic pain than men, their pain is more likely to be dismissed. We know that in studies where men and women present identical symptoms, that women are more likely to be diagnosed with a mental condition instead of a physical one. We know that it can take years for gynecological issues to be diagnosed or treated. Let's see what else. We know that maternal mortality is 4 times higher for Black birthing people. And we all know that reproductive rights are ongoingly under threat around the world. So I think those are just some examples that are really important to sit with and to understand that behind all these examples is problems that when medical practitioners look at women and when women are seeking out care from a medical practitioner, they're up against this double bind of both such a long history of women being seen as hysterical, overly emotional, or dramatic, which means that their pain is more likely to be dismissed. But then there's also fewer treatments and solutions for when women's pain is actually recognized. Mm-hmm. Moreover, other barriers can include stigma and shame surrounding the femme body. So if you're scared to even talk about what's going on with you, it's harder to get care and it's even harder to form communities of care.
Mm-hmm. My next question is a bit similar, so sorry if I'm repeating myself, but so we talked about barriers in the medical setting, but can you tell us more about how gender bias influences our understanding of illness?
Mm-hmm. Maybe since I've given you some facts here, I can draw a bit more on some lived experience, mm-hmm. But also my research. So while I do live with chronic yeast infections, I also have a master's from the University of Cambridge on the subject. So if you do want to learn more, any of our listeners, about my own research, you can check out our YouTube channel. I've published like all our conference talks there and they're pretty accessible, as well as my whole story about suffering with chronic yeast infections is the first one published on Medical Her Story. But chronic yeast infections, if people don't know, 75% of people living with vaginas will get at least one yeast infection in their lifetime, but 5 to 10% will have chronic symptoms that recur on a weekly, monthly, or constant basis and often present for many years. So a yeast infection, if you don't know, means that your genitals can be itching, burning, having weird discharge, and being in a lot of pain. So not very pleasant. And in my own experience, 4 years ago, I first saw a doctor when I had a yeast infection that just wouldn't go away. And this was a really vulnerable setting, right? Like I undressed in front of them, they examined my genitals. I even cried when I was describing the toll that this had taken on my mental health and my daily life. And then I was dismissed with the words, some people get colds, some people get chronic yeast infections. And for a long time, I thought, you know, I'm just seeing weird doctors. I thought maybe this is something I just need to deal with alone and get used to. That's what everyone is telling me. And that it's really no big deal. I started conducting interviews with other women about their experiences within the US, UK, and Canada. And I was so shocked to hear that we are facing such eerily similar experiences of being dismissed within medical care, being just told no one cares, get in, get out, facing the social stigma around being worried that other people are going to see us as gross, and just facing a lack of resources because the treatments that are out there just don't work. And there's not enough research going on or funding within women's health to solve these issues right now. And I guess something else I talk about in my dissertation is that chronic yeast infections are just one example of a larger issue. And I coined this the paradox of a normal problem within women's health, which just goes like this. So follow me. If society stigmatizes quote unquote normal genitals as pathological, then genital pathologies become normalized. So that's maybe a bit of a complicated academic way of saying that we live in this society where vulvas and vaginas are stereotyped as being dirty, smelly, or shameful, even when they're not infected. So that when you are infected, you face that stigma on top of the fact that no matter how much you're going to clean yourself or have self-surveillance, nothing's going to make it better. And it's really disheartening because you face this double stigma of sort of the same one that most women or people with vaginas face and suffer with. But then added on top of that, you come to embody this fear that we're all aware of around gross, dirty, or infected genitals. So that's something that I touch upon. That's just one example of how women's pain and suffering within medical care can be dismissed. But even sometimes when we normalize it, we're causing pain also when we tell women that, oh, menstrual cramps are normal, everyone has them. Oh, yeast infections are normal, most people have them. In some ways that can help destigmatize issues, but other ways, in a lot of other ways, it can actually contribute to more harm.
Now, Medical Herstory is a website, and as mentioned, people can submit stories and their experiences. Can you tell us more about the impact that this connection offers women and femme?
For sure. So we've created Medical Herstory as both a site for healing and criticism, because when we write about our own experiences, that's a great way to sort of process what we've been through, to come to terms with something we've been struggling with or trying to understand. So one aspect of Medical Herstory can stop there once you put your thoughts onto paper. But the other begins when you share that story. So when you share a story about abortion, vaginal cysts, menstruation, and those stories appear on somebody else's timeline, you're either placing that person within two positions. So as the reader, you're placed in one of two positions, right? Either you read this story and the topic becomes humanized to you or normalized to you. And in that way, you become more sympathetic, more empathetic, more educated. Or you recognize your own experience in this story and you know that you're not alone. Or I guess there's a third option in which you read these stories and think, ooh, gross, but then you're just part of the problem. So in sharing these stories, what I'm trying to say is that we do form this community where it's acceptable and encouraged to discuss our stories of being in these messy, uncomfortable bodies. But it's also a space where we can witness others doing the same and sort of turn to them to be role models.
And what have been some of the submissions that you've received that have made an impact on you?
That's a tough question. And I'm honest when I say that they're all my favorites, but every story we received has really impacted me because I've learned so much about other people's experiences and what they faced. And that's coming from someone who for the past 6 years has been within academic spaces focusing on women's health. So that does say a lot, not only about the education that we lack, but how powerful these stories are, that they're really touching on these issues and touching on them in such a way that's really educating everybody. Because we only really live in one experience, right? But storytelling at Medical Herstory is so raw and vulnerable that it really almost lets you see what it's like through that person's eyes or in their body, in my experience at least. I encourage everyone to read them and see if you have the same experience, but we really try to capture that raw emotion. Mm-hmm. And being able to read these stories and really feel them is what makes me a better advocate for others and reflect on my own experience by looking at it in different ways too. I'm really proud to have covered so many topics. If you go on the website, we have things ranging from ovarian cancer to miscarriage, eating disorders, autoimmune diseases, queer experiences, pelvic exams, so much more. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, we try to expand what's traditionally thought of when addressing women's health and open up all of these nuances and details of our experiences from different perspectives. And if you do want me to give an answer, I'll say that two stories that really touched me are Ouchie and So Tight. Funnily enough, they're both about the topic vaginismus, which is a condition where your vaginal muscles can involuntarily contract with penetration of any kind. And that's obviously very painful. Mm-hmm. So in Ouchie, a young woman loses her virginity and is in so much pain and so confused that she visits her doctor, only to be prescribed, not lube, not reassurance, but numbing cream. And in So Tight, however, it details the experience of actually living with vaginismus. So spoiler alert, the first uh, The first experience was simply a young woman losing her virginity and not using lube. And the second one, we sort of get a glimpse into this complex internal battle that goes on living with vaginismus when sex is painful, but you still really want sex. And essentially, if this makes you a bad feminist. So both of these stories use humor to tell their stories, which I think is great and makes them really accessible to read because they do touch on such a heavy topic. But it just makes it more relatable for those of us who have painful sex for whatever reason and raise awareness on it and sort of normalize those discussions, which I think is a great thing to do for women out there and their partners.
Mm-hmm. What is your hope for medical her story moving forward?
Sure. So my hope is that we can continue to share even more stories. If you're listening and you have one to share, we would love to help you publish it. And my goal is that we can use our voices and experiences to start enacting real change within both society and at the medical level. I want to keep creating this space for connection, education, and advocacy at the same time. And I'll give a little shameless plug that we are recruiting volunteers now. So if you're interested in our mission and would like to help us spread awareness and community, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. I did want to ask also, you mentioned at the top of the interview that you also do events or participate in events. Can you tell us a bit about that and some events that you've done?
For sure. So last Sunday, we held a feminist health research conference where we got to hear from students studying anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and history, all addressing health and women's health from a feminist lens. So it was really interesting to see how you could apply sort of this outlook onto different topics. We looked at migrant health, we looked at painful breastfeeding, gestational diabetes, postpartum depression. So that was a great event we did. We also hold some less academic events such as sex positive pub quizzes, where you get to learn a lot about different issues. And then what else have we done? Oh, and then we also love to collaborate. So we're going to collaborate with Thrive Club on an upcoming film screening about women living with chronic illness within Montreal, which we are very excited about.
Oh, wow. Cool. Now, if people want to learn more or join or volunteer, where can they go?
For sure. So you can check out medicalherstory.com to read all our stories or share your own. And you can find us on social media at Medical Her Story. So on Facebook, Instagram, we even have a YouTube channel. So definitely check us out.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Stranded in a snowstorm in a town, you forgot. Take advantage of a warm car and I recess my life. So many years I've given up and now my youth seems shut. I take my place among the truckers and I show them what I got. I told the stripper at the bar the shots we got were magic. Make a wish now come true. As she smiled, a golden tooth glint in the light. And I wonder what she wished for. I just wished for. Red and gold,
your pain. And sweet, sweet forgiveness, you can go back, but it's never the same.
Was Tori from Medical Her Story. Again, you can check them out online at Medical Her Story. That's herstory.com. Up next is a report on chronic pain from our friends at Broad Science.
So imagine waking up every day in pain. Going to bed in pain, constantly thinking about pain, trying to explain your pain, but no one understands, and worst of all, thinking this is how you might live for the rest of your life.
For 1 in 5 Canadians, this is a reality. Although its impact is widespread, chronic pain is not really spoken about, nor really understood. It's a hidden illness that often leaves people suffering in isolation.
According to the Canadian Pain Society, wait times for publicly funded pain clinics can be a year or more. Suicide risks double among chronic pain sufferers, while up to $60 billion a year is racked up in healthcare costs trying to address the issue of chronic pain.
In this episode, we explore chronic pain and the ways that it impacts different societal groups in different ways.
This is Lily.
I'm currently a grad student doing a master's in psychology and mental health at the University of Edinburgh, but I did my undergraduate at McGill.
Lily is now 24, but she's had chronic pain since she was 13, stemming from two separate but overlapping issues, problems with her back and her uterus. Here she is describing the grueling 2.5 year journey that she underwent to finally diagnose her back pain.
If you can take us back to the moment where you first maybe woke up out of bed and started to feel the pain, can you remember that exact moment when you started to realize something is different?
Yeah, I had spent the weekend up north skiing and was like, oh, I must have hurt myself while skiing. And it was a week later when I realized this isn't going away and I think it's feeling it's getting worse. And it was, I'm pretty sure it was something like February 28th. Like, I quite clearly remember. Mm-hmm. And that was the point where I said, what if this back pain doesn't get better? Mm.
And then what did you do?
I tried to figure out what I could do better. So I'd been sort of medicating with just occasional painkillers and so on, but generally just sort of pushing through. And that was the point where I said, okay, maybe I should see an osteopath or someone who can sort of poke things and see if they can fix it. I wasn't aware of how much of an issue it was going to be, or the fact that it was more than just like a sprain or a strain.
So who did you go to see first?
I saw an osteopath first, who a friend of mine had recommended. She was really great. She was very friendly and helpful, and she sort of poked around and said, oh, yeah, like I can feel that it's a little bit out of place here, and I can see from like your gait and from the way that you're standing that things are a little bit unbalanced. And like she did a lot of body manipulation but couldn't really tell me what it was. And so sort of said, well, hopefully it's just something that's muscular or a temporary sort of like joint being not quite where it should be, and we could just massage it and like therapize it back into place essentially.
Next, she went to see a family doctor.
The dickbag doctor. He was old white dude who should have retired 10 years ago probably. Sort of imagine like your crotchiest old uncle who gets really grouchy at you when you disagree with him. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of this guy in lab coat. And he told me that, well, a lot of people have back pain. So
his response to you was, a lot of people have back pain.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was told that I should probably just exercise more or stretch more, or maybe carrying a lighter bag would help.
How did you feel about that?
I was pretty furious. I've been told to carry a lighter bag for a long time, so my mom has a history of back pain, and she was like, you know, your bag is too heavy.
It's the mom thing.
And then being told that I just needed to exercise more was really frustrating, because I think that's something that we're always told is like the cure-all for everything is exercise. Mm. And especially at that point, I was hurting getting out of bed and getting into the shower. So the idea of doing exercise was not really something that I was very keen on.
Can you maybe recount one of your interactions with this doctor and what he said to you and how that made you feel?
Yeah. So this is a GP in Montreal who my dad had seen before, and he was like, this is a great GP. He's very efficient, like, will solve what needs to be solved. And I went to see him, explained that I had these back issues, and he sort of looked at my back, poked it a little bit, and said, well, yes, have some muscle relaxants and some anti-inflammatories, which was fine, except that I went to see him and was a few weeks later and said, you know, these aren't helping, and what else can I do? And he sort of waffled a little bit and said, well, you could do an MRI, and was going to send me privately, which was easily $1,000, $2,000, and said, you know, do some physio and do some more stretching and exercise. Swimming is very good for you. And then when I said, what about medication? Is there anything I can do that will help? And he said, well, if these aren't working for you, I'm not going to re-prescribe them. So when I asked him what he would prescribe, he said, well, I can't really give you anything else. Why don't you just take some Tylenol? And I was furious. I didn't really know what to do at that point.
Let's just take a break here from Lily's story to talk about the science behind chronic pain. What even is it?
That's something I talked about with researcher Jeffrey Mogul, who
is currently a professor of pain studies at McGill University and the Canada Research Chair in the Genetics of Pain.
Well, by definition, chronic pain is pain that lasts for 3 months or more. So shorter lasting pain has a purpose. We have pain when we put our hands on a hot stove to try to prevent or minimize tissue damage. We have pain from a sprained ankle so that we won't put pressure on the ankle, we won't walk on it, and so the injury will heal faster. But chronic pain is a situation where the pain is serving no purpose anymore, there's no injury to be healed, the injury is long healed. Chronic pain is a disease. It's a pathological situation where the alarm bell of pain is now stuck in the on position. Pain is widely still considered a symptom and not a disease of its own. And even when people consider it a disease, it's a disease that goes by very different names. So some people have arthritis, and some people have back pain, and some people have headaches. And these are all thought to be completely separate entities, and they have completely separate foundations, devoted to fundraising for them. And this prevents people from seeing the reality of chronic pain, which is that it's the most prevalent human health problem. If you combine arthritis and back pain and headaches, and I would suggest that you should, because fundamentally, they're all the same problem. Yes, they have different manifestations and different body parts, but ultimately, this is all chronic pain that just happens to be located in different parts of the body for slightly different reasons. If you put them all together, you would quickly realize that we're talking about something that is affecting a fifth or a quarter of anyone at any one time, and one out of two people in their lifetime, and as such is more prevalent than cancer, heart disease, and diabetes combined. And yet, it only gets a fraction of the attention and a fraction of the funding, and that's because people just don't think about it in that way.
Dr. Mogul also mentioned the reason why it is so difficult for people like Lily to get a formal diagnosis or legitimate acknowledgement of their pain mainly comes down to how difficult it is to study chronic pain. We still don't understand the mechanics behind chronic pain, or the beast, as he refers to it.
It's beastly complicated. Really, I want people to understand just how complicated it is. Cancer, for example, is child's play compared to chronic pain, and I will tell you why. Because as complicated as cancer is, and it's really complicated, at least most of the relevant biology is going on in a single cell type, the tumor. And furthermore, it's going on in a cell type that people are actually enthusiastic of you taking out of their bodies so that you can then study it in the laboratory. Pain, on the other hand, is happening not in one cell type. It's happening in multiple cell types all over your nervous system. It's happening in your nerves. It's happening in your spinal cord. It's happening in your cortex. It's happening in your thalamus. It's happening in your amygdala, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And not only is all of the biology that's going on in every one of these cells equal to the complexity of cancer, but then there's the added complexity of how all those neurons and non-neurons, for that matter, are connected to each other. It's really, really hard. It's so hard, in fact, and I'm not going to say that pain is harder than anything else in neuroscience, but as something that's going on in the brain, it's so much more complicated than everything that's not going on in the brain that it is astounding to me that we can study it at all.
This kind of explains how it's possible that Lily went to see one osteopath and two doctors within 6 to 8 months, and none of them were really able to help her.
And at that point, when I got back to Montreal after that summer, I sort of went, well, looks like this is kind of my reality for now, and I don't really know what to do. So I just sort of gave up on looking for treatment.
Lily told us that people found it hard to understand what she was going through, since a lot of people in her life had never experienced chronic pain.
Which is something that likely resonates with a lot of chronic pain sufferers.
It was also a very weird feeling trying to explain to people what was going on, because people are very firm on you having a diagnosis and very much like, oh, what's happening? Can you tell me precisely? And otherwise, and just saying, well, my back's been hurting really badly for a little while is a very vague answer to that and doesn't really meet what people want to hear.
So she turned to an online community that did know what she was going through.
So first it started off through Tumblr. I was just following some blogs and then found this thing. Someone was saying, oh, I've been told that I'm too young to look this, too young to feel this old for like the 10th time this month. Do I get a medal? And I was amused and then found that someone who was running a meme called Chronically Ill Cat had started a Facebook group for people who were told that they were too young to feel this old. So I joined that, and it was a really great group, fractioned and split off, but I'm still sort of closely involved in a few Facebook groups that are for chronically ill and disabled people. I'd say are some of my closest friends now, probably a lot of them, because it was just sort of commiserating about, like, wow, this sucks, and a lot of people don't get this, and that's just kind of the thing we have to live with, so we can at least provide support to each other.
In parallel with Lily's back pain, she was also suffering from endometriosis, which is a very painful disorder that occurs when the tissue lining the uterus spreads outside to places where it does not belong. This can happen for a number of reasons and can cause all kinds of other painful side effects, like scarring and bleeding.
For some women, this pain is debilitating and on average takes more than 7 years to be diagnosed. Endometriosis affects roughly 8 in every 1,000 people with uteruses.
So I started seeing a gynae who was really talking to me about trying to figure that out, what that was, and who put me on some medication and went to the ER. And despite being in a lot of pain and losing a lot of blood, the doctor did some blood tests and said at the end, well, your blood tests are normal, so you can go home now. Ignoring the fact that I had turned out to the ER delirious from pain.
Wow, Lord.
And just sort of said, well, you can go home. Your blood tests are normal. And when I said that there's an issue, said, well, I can't make up anemia and you're not anemic, so your blood test. So here's a prescription. Why don't you just go home and get some rest?
Meanwhile, Lily's back pain situation was about to reach a major breakthrough.
And I went into the McGill Health Center at some point, sort of in crisis because I was in a lot of really bad pain and was hoping to get a referral for physio, and the doctor there referred me for an MRI at the Montreal General, which I had a few months later, that confirmed that it wasn't all in my head and that yes, my back was actually properly fucked up.
That's an important statement, I think, that it wasn't all in your head.
I think I was concerned about maybe the fact that I was exaggerating, or you know, maybe people are in pain like this and I'm just a weakling and feel like this is overwhelming when it shouldn't be.
How did you feel after kind of years of being told it was all in your head and to do exercise? Like, what was that like when someone finally started empathizing to the point where they seemed to be making progress with your diagnosis?
I think I laughed. Because I was just like, this is so unreal. Like, thank you for saying this, but also, are you sure you're a doctor? And yeah, and when I saw her for my results as well, she was like, you should be really relieved. At least you know what it is, and hopefully we can try and figure out, like, treatment and physiotherapy will hopefully work. And she also said, wow, you really must be in a lot of pain.
So this is one of the biggest debates in pain going on at the moment.
That's Mogul again.
There are some who believe, and I'm one of them, that pain is fundamentally subjective, and we don't like that. Everyone hates that that is true, and of course it is makes our research very hard, it makes treatment very hard, but that's just the way it is. That's the nature of the beast.
Mogul also explained that the subjectivity of pain, you know, the fact that people experience and report pain differently, is one of the barriers to treating chronic pain properly.
One, of course, is the fact that it's subjective. And things that are subjective tend to be taken less seriously by the healthcare system than things that there are scans for, right? Mm-hmm. Tests for. If it comes up on a blood test, you've got something and they're prepared to deal with it.
Sounds familiar.
The doctor did some blood tests and said at the end, well, your blood tests are normal, so you can go home, go home.
The thing is, science is not the biggest fan of subjectivity. It's hard to understand cause and effect when the scales of pain are so widely inconsistent.
I ask you how much pain you're in, you say a 7. what am I supposed to do with that? What does a seven mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know that your seven is the same as my seven. I have no idea.
That's why some scientists are looking for ways to make pain research more objective.
There's an increasing minority that believe that imaging might be used to create an objective measure of pain, a painometer, if you will. And this is starting to be taken quite seriously, for example, in the courts, that you might be able to use imaging technology to decide objectively whether a person was in pain, regardless of what they said. There are some in the pain field that look on this development with horror. I think it would be very, very dangerous to ever replace a proxy of a thing with the thing.
On the other hand, objectivity isn't all that bad.
That the one thing we have learned from imaging, I don't think that, scanners can be used as painometers, but at least they've proven to us that chronic pain is real. It's not in your head. It does show up on scans.
Mogul makes a great point here. Maybe by combining subjective reports with the objective power of brain imaging, we can eventually get a better understanding of pain.
But of course, as Mogul pointed out, we're not quite there yet, and this research is far from black and white.
So after years of searching, being bounced around a broken healthcare system, 5 to 6 doctors, and a whole lot of frustration, Lily finally found a diagnosis.
A name for the problem she always knew existed.
So I have 2 herniated discs in my back and like other impacted or compacted joints and muscles back there. And that I have stage 2 endometriosis.
We asked Lily whether, looking back at all the healthcare professionals she saw, she was made to feel safe, and if she felt that they knew what they were doing.
No, not really.
Well, I can't say I'm surprised.
Yeah, I can't say I'm surprised either, but I think that we don't fully understand the extent of this problem in the healthcare system. And when I was talking to Dr. Mogul, he told me that this problem can be traced back to basic education.
I think the major problem there is that pain doesn't fit neatly into anyone's current conception of disease. And that's the way medical school always has been organized. It's always been organized by body part and disease type. And because pain cuts across, it doesn't get any attention. Yes, they talk about, opioids for a while and pretend they're talking about pain, and they talk about side effects of Tylenol and aspirin and say they're talking about pain. If you want a disturbing statistic, you can consider that veterinarians almost certainly get 4 or 5 times the training in pain as medical doctors do.
Well, there's a comforting thought.
Yeah, it's messed up. And at the end of the day, Dr. Mogul says, on average, medical students probably get around 4 hours. Four hours of actual pain education.
So it sounds like Lily's mistrust of this system is entirely justified.
Exactly. When we asked Lily whether her healthcare professionals interacted with her any differently, seeing as she was a young female, she was quick to answer.
Absolutely, 100%. I think that being young, for one thing, is sort of a, oh, well, bless, like you don't really know what real pain is sort of thing. But also just the sort of, yeah, you have some herniated discs, or like, yes, you've got back pain, but like you're probably a student who's studying too much and who's like doesn't have very good posture and is not doing enough exercise and carries a heavy book bag with lots of textbooks. So being a woman's concern, yeah, probably as well, actually definitely, especially when it comes to endometriosis, which is a condition that only affects people who have uteri, so not, yeah, not all people with uteri are women, but like affects people with uterus, and you know how your uterus functions and how your body functions and what is normal or not. And I think the lack of, like, the fact that doctors were just really unwilling to believe me when I said this is not my normal, and I know what my normal is and this is not it, is definitely down to a sort of believing that women are overdramatic or maybe irrational or make a big deal out of things that aren't that big a deal. And especially because endometriosis is a gynae condition, I feel like there's a lot of things often boil down to, oh, well, periods. Yeah. Oh, well, uteri. Oh, well, of course you're not going to be happy about this because that's what it is.
By the way, Lily said she believes this is true of both male and female doctors in her experience. So what is going on?
We know that women experience and report more chronic pain than men, and they make up the majority of chronic pain patients.
Some estimates say up to 70%.
But beyond that, there is evidence to support a gender bias in chronic pain treatment.
You see, it starts with basic research. Until recently, almost 79% of basic pain research done on mice or rats has been done exclusively on males.
For instance, one justification for this bias by researchers has been chalked up to the difficulty in controlling for menstrual cycles. Lazy research methods lead to incomplete scientific knowledge. So already, pain research has a major methodological flaw.
Essentially, what that means is our current pain models are incomplete.
Despite the fact that women make up the majority of patients seeking chronic pain treatment, they are often more likely to receive delayed or inadequate treatment.
If you want to read about the research yourself, you can check out our website. Multiple studies have found that women tend to wait longer for painkillers than their male counterparts with the same symptoms, and they are likely to be treated less aggressively. If you're a woman, these delays could cost you your mental and physical well-being, or even your life.
When it comes down to it, the healthcare system often feels that women exaggerate their pain.
Women are put in the position of having to prove that they really actually are feeling pain. But really, the root of the problem is that doctors don't have enough pain knowledge, and their judgments can quickly be replaced by common gender biases.
Don't forget that this isn't limited to pain research. This is a systemic problem within the healthcare structure at large.
Another beast in its own right that we don't really have time to tackle here.
Suffice to say that a lot more research needs to be done in this field.
Because what we currently have is just not good enough. What would you say to somebody who is experiencing something like you experienced, where they are in chronic pain and they don't see a way out and their doctors are being dismissive? What would you say to them?
I would say definitely you're not alone. Your pain is valid. Your feelings about your pain are valid. And I would say that it's so important to find support. So to find a community of people who are going to maybe help you to understand that there are possibly no solutions, but on the other hand, there are ways of coping with pain that might be different. But mainly having community people who get it and who won't say what some of your able friends might say, which is, oh yeah, that sucks, so why can't you come out tonight? But who will instead say, it's totally valid that you want to just stay in your bed and cry because you're in so much pain, and that sucks, and it's okay for you to be angry and to lose faith in the medical system. And people who will also try and support you when you're trying to figure out what to ask your doctor, for instance.
Wise words from our new friend, Lily.
Chronic pain is real. It's not in your head.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Thank you so much for listening to today's show and to our guests, Tori, and our friends at Broad Science. Be sure to tune in a few weeks from now for more reports on gender-based issues.
Some ugly old fur. Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus de renseignements sur l'application et apprendre comment la télécharger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
So, other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca.
Oh, yeah! I want to be your motivator.
CKUT Radio.
Radio. Sound waves in the air.
CKUT, Montreal, Canada.